we can make a change, and we have made a change, and there is so much more scope to actually enhance this.
G'day, my name's Anthony James, this is The Regeneration, and that was Jeff Bastian. You might remember my conversation with Keith Bradby from GondwanaLink for episode 79 a few weeks ago. If you haven't heard it yet, suffice to say here that GondwanaLink has been called the most exciting thing happening in restoration in Australia, if not the world. Within its 1,000-kilometre restoration zone lies the Oyster Harbour catchment. And the harbour that does the catching has drawn renown as the site of the world's most successful seagrass restoration, with a humble bloke by the name of Jeff Bastian at the heart of it. Jeff is regarded as a bit of a local legend around Albany in the south of Western Australia, and a few years ago he was duly awarded the prestigious Great Southern Development Commission Medal. It was back in the 1970s that Jeff first noticed the local harbours losing their vital seagrass meadows. He self-funded a monitoring effort over the next decade, by which time almost all the seagrass was gone. The harbours were effectively desertifying, largely due to industrial and agricultural runoff. But as older industries closed, and farmers, the local catchment group and others inland reduced agricultural runoff, Jeff was painstakingly pioneering a way to restore the seagrass, when conventional wisdom suggested it couldn't be done. And what that means for marine habitat and food, preventing coastal erosion, and for what's come to be called blue carbon, can't be overstated. Generously meeting me waterside in Albany, here's Jeff.
Jeff, great to speak with you here. Thanks for joining me. You want to tell the listeners where we are, locate us?
Oh, we're sitting on the boat harbour at Princess Royal Harbour in Albany.
What is this landscape? What have you learned about this landscape and seascape?
I grew up here pretty much as a kid, so I think the more relevant things to me were seeing the changes that both of the harbours, Princess Royal and Oyster Harbour, were going through back in the 60s and 70s, and we had a huge amount of environmental degradation. Predominantly, it was the loss of the seagrass that was the main issue.
Yeah, you want to run us through that?
Yeah, Princess Royal Harbour, the seagrass losses there were due to industrial inputs and uncontained dredging, which obviously changed the environment in terms of adding additional nutrients and reducing the light climate, etc. But Oyster Harbour, which I was particularly fond of, having grown on the North Shore there, it has two major rivers, the King and the Kalgan. And essentially, about 1962, the major problems started to develop, and that was due to the release of superphosphate. That became available in about 1962, and the Kalgan catchment was then cleared. At the moment, it's 90% cleared, and that meant farmers could actually grow crops on what was gutless, very nutrient-deficient sands. So between 1962 and the mid-1970s, a huge amount of the catchment was cleared, and that involved bulldozing, windrow, and then burning. So my concept of this is that once this happened, we have a huge amount of sediment washing into the harbours. Also, we're having a lot of nutrients from the burnt vegetation and then superphosphate being applied. Sandy soils don't retain the phosphorus. So very quickly, through the late 60s and early 70s, we had a dramatic increase in both phytoplankton and epiphytic algae, which is living attached to the seagrass communities.
Right.
That reduced the light availability, so the seagrasses started to die out through the late 70s. By the early 1980s, seagrass was only present down to about 2 metres. That would have survived, except for the fact that we had a very large growth of unattached macroalgae, which then basically was wind-driven, just steamrolled around the edge of the harbour and completely removed all of that seagrass.
Wow. Mm. And so is that the moment when you started to gear your attention so strongly towards it, or when did you start to intervene and ring the alarm?
Well, back in 1981 and then again in 84, I mapped the seagrasses and submitted a report to the EPA, and that was based on my observations, and I could see that the system was deteriorating hugely. I then, or the EPA then, followed up with a small investigation and then initiated a big study, the Albany Harbour Study, that ran from 1987 to 1989. Following that, a lot of measures were implemented to try and reduce the nutrient inputs. So a lot of things started to change. Industries closed down. There used to be several fish canneries, an abattoir, the sewage outfall at the entrance to Princess Royal Harbour was discharging. That was removed in 1990, and
the system was still declining.
The system, you know, was static by that time. A huge amount of macroalgae in Princess Royal Harbour. In Oyster Harbour, the macroalgae was fairly limited because the wind had driven it into the very shallows, and eventually it became the shoreline. At that stage, most of the seagrass in an area that I was particularly working on, which was over 3 kilometres in length down the eastern shoreline, there was only a couple of hectares left. Today, we're looking at somewhere around about 146 hectares there. So it's been a dramatic turnaround. Mm. Part of it is due to seagrass restoration work. A lot of it is the better management practices in the farming communities.
Yes.
And I think, you know, we've had a lot of stabilisation of the farmland by deep-rooted crops. Blue gums have been planted quite extensively as well. All of that better management, land care groups, fencing and revegetating streamlines, all of that has reduced the inputs into Oyster Harbour, and the system has happened, you know, fortunately, to actually establish itself. So
yeah.
it's
to effectively 100%. It's
no, at the moment, depending where you are,
yeah.
Within the harbour, within my main study area, the seagrasses are virtually 100% covered down to 2.8 metres mean water depth. That you still find isolated patches down to 4.5 metres, but in reality, it would take many, many years before they actually establish widespreadly through to that 4 to 5 metres. I don't think that I'll actually go any further, any deeper. Historically, they were down to at least 8 metres.
Mm.
But
and you'd like to be embarking on that next
year. Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah, but there's not been the interest to date. To do that?
No, with the seagrass restoration work that I commenced in 1994 and demonstrated that it was actually achievable, and you know, a considerable number of hectares have been directly planted, but then the strategy of restoring the grasses in patterns has facilitated the recruitment of seed. And so the growth has really exploded. But there was a little bit of a hype back in the mid to late 2010, 2016. But now it has actually become quite quiet again. So,
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the story of how this success was achieved. Remarkable success and a brilliant story, including its humble beginnings. So run us through how you'd come out here and get started on your restoration, how it sort of evolved.
Well, I've grown up on the water, and
yeah.
So diving has always been you know, one of my real hobbies. But once I moved down here in 1994, I just wanted to have a bit of a go at trying to transplant seagrasses, which at that stage it was considered to not be a viable option. I had a couple of ideas based on observations with terrestrial grasses, mainly lawns, and I put that to test in Oyster Harbour and had a remarkable success. You know, 97% survival rates, very rapid growth. So,
And you literally started this just on your little fishing sojourns?
Basically, yes. I like to chase the blue swimmer crabs around, and that was just something that I did. After the initial success, I set up some more comprehensive trials, a little foolishly in the sense that I still wasn't confident in what the survival was going to be. So my plots were substantially larger than they needed to be, so that created a huge amount of additional work. But, you know, once that happened, then I started restoration work. Some of it was funded in a sense. In 2001, the Coast Care, Coast West, organised a day where we chartered a boat and provided bits and pieces for, and we had about 26 volunteers, and on Australia Day, and we planted out 0.8 of a hectare, which is a beautiful meadow now.
Yeah, well.
And following that, there's been some research programs initiated, and the seagrass research and rehabilitation program was initiated by Department of Infrastructure and Resources and Coburn Cement. They had a ministerial requirement that they had to restore so many hectares of seagrass as an offset to seagrass loss due to mining lime sands in Coburn Sound and also construction of a boat harbour there. And so I was incorporated into that, and through that we did some more restoration, another 1.5 hectares, and it just sort of went on from there.
Yeah, and you found then that this long-term degradation, and where it'd been effectively given up on officially, actually happened, the restoration ended up happening remarkably quickly.
Yes, and you know, the area that I've been working on, and I was chartering planes every 4 or 5 years and photographing this, so you can actually see the restoration and the trials proceeding. And in this area, back in 1989, there was only several hectares, and now we're looking at about 146 hectares. So that's, you know, a really dramatic turnaround. Yeah.
Did that surprise you?
Yes, it did. I mean, I was always hopeful, but the promising aspect of this is that the system has, it's not restored to its natural, you know, pristine sort of condition, but it's a dramatic improvement, and it's a credit to a lot of people in various fields, and it's a indicative that we can make a difference. One little study that was done several years ago, for instance, was that the restored seagrass stores anywhere from 30 to maybe 50 times the carbon that per hectare compared to, say, the Amazon rainforest.
Yeah, amazing.
So it's very important in carbon sequestering.
Yes. We'll come back to that. For the moment, run us through the story of what you stumbled on in terms of the most effective way to get that restoration going on that ended up being so much simpler, again, than what was expected.
Yeah, and I think sometimes people overthink stuff. I had just an observation from gardening on land, and if you take, say, a piece of buffalo grass or kaikuyu, the runners which actually intrude on your footpath, if you cut those off and plant them, they actually grow and spread very rapidly. I also noticed that if you cut a sod out of the middle of the lawn and plant it, it would survive, but it would take a year and a half before it would put out runners. And I just decided to test that with seagrasses and found exactly the same thing. If you took the advancing edge of a meadow, that would grow very rapidly, which enables it to cope with sand accumulation, macroalgal drifts, that sort of thing. And so that type of rhizome pioneers and colonises the sediment very quickly, and then it infills later on. I did find that the rhizome that I took from within a meadow, I still had the same survival. It still grew in terms of leaf production at the same rate, but it didn't spread. It sat there for 18 months before it put out these running shoots called plagiotropic shoots, and then it would continue. So it was just a very simple system. You can swim around the edge of a patch of seagrass or meadow and remove, you know, a sprig every 30, 40 centimetres. I've demonstrated that there is no impact on that. And those sprigs are very, very light, easy to transport around, and very easily attached or implanted into the sediment. So it was a you know, very cost-effective way to actually proceed.
Yeah, and what are the implications then for other regions? Does it work elsewhere?
Yeah, and it works with most species. I've played around with species that grow vertically out in King George Sound, Posidonia coriacea. As long as you can hold it down until the roots take hold, which is only a matter of weeks, that will grow. Mm. Weed, amphibolous species, that grows beautifully too. Basically, they all grow as long as you can hold them in place and you put them in the natural environment that they occur in.
Yeah, so that's an interesting point then, because that was part of why officialdom had given up on it, right? That they had tried, but not putting it in the right set of conditions.
I think there were two parts to that. Probably they may, restoration attempts might have been targeting a bare area, but the bare area might not have been where they naturally grow. The other aspect is
those conditions.
Most of them were actually taking cores. You take a core, you take a core well into a seagrass meadow, and as a result, you had the type of rhizome which would only grow vertically and would not spread rapidly, initially at least, and that would make it prone to wave action, sediment movement, etc., and it would be buried and smothered.
Yep.
So I think there's a number of... And probably the other thing too is that you can only restore, say, a seagrass after it's been lost when the conditions that resulted in its loss have actually been rectified.
Yes, yes. Well, that's an interesting point too. Now, when we look at some of the restoration that's happened up around Shark Bay, for example, that's also been terrifically successful since the last shocking marine heat wave 10 or so years ago. And we're forecast to have another one. And this is part of the issue, isn't it, that we're getting these things more frequently before the recovery can really set in. And now the people up at Ningaloo and Shark Bay are sort of on tenterhooks for the next couple of months as to what it might bring with this heat wave. What about that? And what about that even here? Is this something that you're sort of on the lookout for, whether the recoveries will be compromised here?
I don't think... on the south coast, that the recovery will be compromised, because even though we do have these periods of warmer water, and during the last heat wave, we were getting the odd mud crab down in the Albany region. You know, so
you wouldn't get that normally.
No, you would not. But the increases in temperature, water temperature, relatively low compared to the scenario up at Shark Bay. Mm. The waters are already quite warm, yeah. You know, probably in your mid-20s, and then you get another 3 or 4 degrees on there, it will definitely cook the seagrass. But here, the changes are much more reduced. And when you look at a system like Princess Royal and Oyster Harbour, in the very shallows, on Albany's rare hot days, the water actually gets very warm. You know, it would be 25, 26 degrees, and doesn't kill the seagrass. So,
More margin for here.
I think we've got more margin. Yeah. The big concern is the Shark Bay area.
Yeah. Yeah. So what about that? What are people trying to do to prepare, knowing that this is sort of the way it's going to be into the future? Are you aware of some of the measures they've tried to take in their restoration efforts?
I haven't been involved, but I am aware. But I think the issue with Shark Bay and seagrass restoration there is that, again, it's only going to be potentially viable if and when seagrasses become more tolerant to warmer temperatures. Mm. You know, so it's much the same with coral bleaching through the same events. Exactly. And I was reading an article that's, I think, in the Saudi Gulf, there are corals growing there which are growing at much higher temperatures than what we're seeing on the Barrier Reef with the bleaching. Oh. So there is potential that in time, you know, something will...
Some adaptation.
Adapt to it, yes.
Yeah, while we hopefully take the foot off the heating pedal.
Well, exactly, yes.
Yeah. I was going to ask that about around the world. And are there any other sort of startling examples of this sort of work succeeding in other places?
Yes, in the US there's been quite a lot of work with one of the species of seagrasses there. I think most of the effort has been collecting seed and dispersing seed.
Yes, which seems to work as well in some places.
It does, yes.
And that's the Shark Bay.
And Shark Bay is using that. With the situation in Oyster Harbour, the seagrass wasn't there to provide seed, so there was no seed, so it had to be planted. And I found that my transplants were flowering in their fifth year. So there was remnant seagrass in Oyster Harbour, but that tended not to fruit successfully. And I think the main reason was that even though they flowered, the flowers were actually being eaten by some sort of snail. So the whole ecological balance was upset by the deterioration in the water quality. And so we weren't getting that seed accumulating in the harbour. But once the transplants became successful and flowered, we started seeing a lot of seed coming through.
Yes. And you mentioned before the agricultural situation, that the change in landscape management in the catchment area was a big factor, and that's connected to the broader Gondwana Link project, which we spoke about with Keith little earlier. So effectively then your work's regarded as part of that networked connecting approach across a large stretch of country and incorporating these waterscapes.
Exactly, and I think the main thing that can come out of this story is to provide encouragement to the farmers, land care groups, etc., that we can make a change, and we have made a change, and there is so much more room, so much more scope to actually enhance this.
Yeah, what do you see? What sort of vision is in your mind?
One of the things that I'm interested in is now is that we a lot of species of animals and birds, particularly the cockatoos, the red and the white tail, the carnivores, that are becoming endangered or more endangered because of loss of habitat. And this ties in with, always has tied in with Keith's work and Gondwana Link, but even through the southwest, the provision of the right vegetation, for instance, as food and nesting sites for these species is critical. And in Albany at the moment, a heavy haulage ring road is being constructed over the next 3 years, and they've already identified two areas. One is revegetation for cockatoos, and the other is for the passage of ring-tailed possums. So these are just little things that are now being considered. So people are becoming more and more aware. Mm. And I think with the rural communities, so much of the area has been cleared that not just the original Gondwana Link concept, but you know that the same thing needs to be extended right through the catchment and farming communities.
Yeah, that's right. You know, you mentioned that heavy haulage infrastructure, and I think are we still doing ourselves in by, you know, all this awesome restoration work, but in parallel, continuing with the massive industrial expansion project? Is there a contradiction there we're going to have to face at some point?
There certainly is, but I'm just concerned that the processes that we need to undertake, it's something that we can't just do overnight.
Yes.
The planning has to be put in place. And
yes.
Yeah, probably not really answering your question there.
Suffice to say, bigger picture, longer term, collective view of where we want to go.
Exactly. And, you know, in the case of the Albany Harbours, you know, we're looking at in excess of 30 years of change. You know, that's been a long process. But it has happened,
yes.
and it will continue to improve.
Yeah.
So restoration on the terrestrial side, we're looking at quite long terms for these communities to be established. If you're planting a lot of trees, you know, they're probably going to be, you know, 10, 20, 30 years before you've got a reasonable community there. So
yeah. And you're a businessman too, obviously working in a nursery now, amongst other things, and it makes me think what the changing nature of our economies and communities and our understanding of even what it is to be wealthy and prosperous and developed, quote unquote, in the future context, where we're dealing with those sorts of time frames, but we're also dealing with understandings we mentioned earlier of carbon, for example, the value of biodiversity, you know, all these sorts of things. It makes me think a lot about what our economies will look like with those changes sort of integrated into it over time.
Yes, and there are a lot of other issues that we haven't even embraced yet. You know, salinity, loss of agricultural land through salinity is it's increasing every year, and it's a massive issue. That's going to have a huge effect on the economy, just through the loss of land. So,
yes. Yet by the same token, we have the restoration examples and models out there in the Wheatbelt, for example, as well. So we know how to do it. We've done it. Again,
yes.
Same thing.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, it comes down to cost. To undertake any sort of restoration work, it's extremely expensive. And you know, there just isn't the funding. So it really has to come from the bigger and more profitable, you know, mining, petroleum industry, and so on.
Yes, interesting. Mm. I guess until you've got a recognition of value that's embodied in other ways, so that's the carbon market, for example, is that something you've... I mean, you mentioned earlier the extraordinary value in seagrasses in that respect. Is that something you've had your eye on to kick in at some point and help shift these value systems, ultimately?
Yes, and I think with the carbon system, from a seagrass point of view, here in Albany, we've only got a limited area where we could actually tie that up. You know, that can still be restored. But we can't expand that into King George Sound, because basically the seagrass communities are established and static. So we don't have the room for that. But we have to consider, when you look at the areas that have been lost due to the marine heatwave in Shark Bay, it makes Albany pale to insignificance, you know, in terms of areas. Mangrove systems are equally important for this. And there has been a lot of loss of that, apparently, up in the Northern Territory.
Yes, indeed. And it makes you think, too, about just stewardship, just maintenance of intact ecosystems like the one that you've restored here, that value, you know, the old care for country, that value is maintained and cared for over time.
Exactly. And you know, at the moment I've got some concerns is that in Oyster Harbour the aquaculture zoning has expanded. It's been increased to 500 hectares, and the majority of that encompasses the 146 hectares that I've been working on. Not to say that aquaculture can't coexist, but I think we have to be very careful on how we actually manage it, and we need to get a much better understanding of the effects.
Yeah, no, good case in point, exactly. So to wind up, Jeff, what's your sense of, and this can be as narrow or broad as you like, what's needed most right now?
The awareness is there. for, you know, both the marine environments and the terrestrial side. It's actually funding. Funding is critical. There are a lot of people undertaking small-scale work, which has, you know, a good benefit on a small scale, but we need a much broader scale. And funding, as I say, whether it's, it comes from the government or whether it's from industry, it's something that we do need.
I gather then is a development of awareness into almost a political constituency that leads to the hand of funding flowing more freely into these things, that there needs to be a movement of some description that would legitimise and, you know, back that in at a political or even corporate level a little more than it has.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. So the awareness is one thing, but the next level of actually acting on it is the elusive bit.
Exactly. And as you've already stated, we've already demonstrated multiple areas that restoration, whether it's in salt-affected country or seagrass or it's marginal farmland, etc., is doable. It just requires the resources.
Beautiful. Jeff, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks for coming out on The Point here with me and having this yarn. I always close each episode by asking my guests to cite a piece of music that's been significant in their lives in some fashion. Even as a kid here, growing up.
Didn't really have much music.
Really?
Because on the water all the time. On it or in it.
So
all I heard was the wave song and the wind. it's, you know, I mean, I grew up without TV, you know, and we were always out. We didn't have the problems with stranger danger, and we were out in the bush or on the water and in the water, under the water. It was
that's the soundtrack of your life.
That's probably my soundtrack. Even though I do love music, but there's not a particular track that I could associate with what I've been doing.
No, bloody good answer. Cheers, Jeff. Thanks.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was the internationally recognised pioneer of seagrass restoration, Jeff Bastian. For more on Jeff, the Oyster Harbour seagrass restoration, and how you can help more of this restoration happen, see the links in our program details. You'll see a few pics on the episode's webpage too. And if you'd like to hear more about the extraordinary potential for seagrass restoration at scale that Jeff was talking about, tune into my conversation with Professor Gary Kendrick for the Clean State podcast last year. He's another WA pioneer who's been central to seagrass restoration efforts at the World Heritage-listed Shark Bay and elsewhere on the West Coast. You'll find our conversation in episode 2 of the Clean State podcast, Blue Carbon, Conservation Economies and the Great Seagrass Restoration. That link's in the show notes too. Jeff actually tells me that he and Gary were born on the same day and in the same hospital ward. Clearly something in the air that day. Makes me wonder who else was born there. Oh, and the marine heatwave we spoke about in this episode? We're in the midst of it now. I'm not sure about the seagrass down south, but standing here by Ningaloo Reef, it seems to be hanging on. There's been no major bleaching or other disruptions so far. So we anxiously hope for this particular heatwave to end soon, giving us a little more scope to get our holistic regenerative act together. The Regeneration is an independent production, made ad-free and freely available thanks to the generous support of listeners. Special thanks this week to connector extraordinaire and instigator of the Regen WA network, Justin Wolfgang, for your enormous support in making the Gondwana Link episodes possible, both with Keith Bradby and here with Jeff. Thank you to Jim for your valued support, and I hope the move's going well. If you too value what you hear, please consider joining Justin and Jim by visiting the website via the show notes, regeneration.com. Thanks as always for your support, and thanks too for rating, sharing and commenting on the podcast. And Margaret, Louise, Grimm and family, Nick and Tim, Tanya and Chris, thanks for your wonderful hospitality while we were down south. My name's Anthony James. Thanks for listening.